case, the United States versus Suffron. Ms. Pilola? Obviously, you're not Victoria Pilola.
Not the last time I checked, Judge, no.
All right. Obviously, my card. And you are?
My name is Victor M. Pilola, and I represent Marisol Pilola.
All right. Well, we apologize for...
Oh, not at all, Judge.
It's either the way you sign in or the way we interpret your signature. But in any event, we're pleased to see you here.
Thank you, Judge. I hope so. Please, the court. I'd like to start off by pointing something that should be obvious to all of us. But in the case of this, I think it's good that we remind ourselves of, and that is that in cases like this, we have sophisticated government surveillance and wiretaps and cooperating witnesses. The government really has this kind of a case down pat. The question of guilt or innocence often becomes secondary to the question of the quantity of drugs that are involved. As the defense counsel who's been involved in a few of these cases, I can confidently say that we often find ourselves preoccupied with this latter question of quantity of drugs, because on it depends whether our defendant gets 5 years or whether our defendant gets 50 years. And particularly when huge amounts of drugs are bandied about, but at the end of the day, there is no drug hoard, and there is no big money seizure, and the defendants usually end up with the panel attorneys as their representatives. And this is one of those cases. It's also one of those cases that arose just before Apprendi was decided, which means that the indictment does not contain allegations of specific quantities of controlled substances, and therefore that issue was not presented to the jury. Under this general set of facts, then, Apprendi held that this constitutes...
Counsel, I'm puzzled. Who are you representing in this case?
Marisol Pilon, Judge. She...
Wasn't she convicted under CCE, or was she the only...
No, she was not convicted of CCE.
The only non-CCE person...
Right, Judge. She was a conspiracy, right, Judge. And some telephone counts. So that under this set of facts, under Apprendi, this would constitute plain error, and both parties are agreed on that. The only question, then, is...
Well, wait. And what was Marisol Colon's total sentence?
Judge, she received a mandatory minimum of 10 years.
Right. And we've held that anybody involved in any quantity of cocaine or heroin can be sentenced up to 20 years without any error at all under Apprendi. So I'm a little puzzled by the nature of the argument.
Well, Your Honor, this is one of those situations where co-counsel have collaborated on a joint brief, and so I would be arguing on their behalf on this issue.
The other appellants were convicted of CCE.
That's right, Judge.
And the maximum sentence for every person convicted of running a continuing criminal enterprise is life imprisonment, and we've therefore held that Apprendi has no relevance whatsoever to CCE convictions, which is why I'm so puzzled by the nature of this argument.
Well,
your client got less than 20 years, and the other two defendants got less than life, so no one has received a sentence greater than the statutory maximum.
Well, that's true, Judge, and I certainly can't change the law in this regard in this circuit. And I understand that 5 kilos or more and all that it's all that is needed to put a defendant in the 10 years to life category. But from the defendant's point of view, and what he sees and what he's preoccupied with is the differing quantity categories. Is it between 50 or 150 kilograms? Is it between 50? Is it over 15 and less than 50? Is it more than 5 or is it less than 15? So as a practical matter, which category he falls in makes all the difference in the world as far as he's concerned. But from a due process point of view, we tell him that, well, if he's over 5 kilos, it really doesn't make any difference. But as judges and as lawyers, we strive for fairness in the law. But from the layman's point of view, he listens to his gut as to what's fair and what's not. And sometimes judges, the gut is a better gauge of fairness in the law. And so this question that I'm raising here is a question of prejudice in terms of the sentence, and not in terms of guilt or innocence. And the two bases for my argument is that the critical information regarding the issue of the quantity of drugs, information which bears directly on the sentence that these individuals received, were withheld from the defense until it was too late. And the first instance was that one Wilfredo Escobar, who was perhaps the main witness against the defendants, testified that the conspiracy involved 150 kilograms of cocaine. But in Mr. Escobar's pre-sentence report, the government ratcheted down that estimate to 45 kilograms based on the recollection of another witness, and comparing that number with the audio tapes themselves. And of course, this information was given to the defense at a time when it really couldn't do anything at all with it. And the second basis, the second thing that was withheld, or rather was not withheld, but the defense filed a motion for a bill of particulars 2 months before trial. And the motion for bill of particulars asked for specific quantities of drugs that were involved, because, according to the motion, it bore directly on the statutory maximums that the defendants were faced with. This motion was summarily denied by the district court.
And you know, was this argument raised in your brief?
Judge, it was not, Judge. We tried to raise it after the briefs were filed, because it was an oversight. This case involved a 2 or 3 month trial, 6,000 pages of transcripts, and several boxes of discovery, and we apologize if it was not raised in the brief, but we did try to raise it. It is a matter of record. The bill of particulars is in the record, number 259. The minute order denying this motion summarily is at 311, Judge. And we feel obligated. We have to bring this to the attention of the court because we feel it's important. Now, those are the two bases for the prejudice aspect of my argument. Now, we have we've all argued in our briefs that the 841A1A, as applied to the defendants, was unconstitutional. I will not argue that orally, and also we have an argument regarding the mandatory minimum, and I will not present that to the court. We would just stand on our brief and thank the court for its attention.
Thank you very much, Mr. Miller. All right, Mr. Collins.
Good morning.
Good morning, Court.
Counsel for the government, co-counsel. I'd like to get one thing straight, first of all. Two people were convicted of the CCE, my client, Gustavo Colon, and Mr. Martinez. The other two people were not charged with or convicted of the CCE. There's a lot of issues that were raised in the case, and I certainly don't purport to be able to address them all now. I'd just like to talk about a couple of things.
Are you going to address the Brady, Virgilio?
Yes, I was going to talk about our stuff, if I might. This was a case where a lot of material was produced in discovery, but unfortunately a lot of material that was known to the government was not produced in discovery. And the name Joseph Majanowski pops up in a number of cases in this particular matter. Even in the beginning, his name did pop up because he was a partner with an officer by the name of John Woodall, who had searched Mr. Souffrant's apartment sometime prior to the trial in this matter and prior to the charges being filed. Mr. Majanowski's name wended its way through the matters for quite a while, and particularly in the post-trial proceedings. And one of the things that was particularly important, which would have led to the discovery of lots of information that we could have utilized to the benefit of our clients at the trial, was an incident that occurred about 7 years ago. In 1995, a young woman by the name of Evelyn Miranda was arrested by Mr. Majanowski, by Mr. Woodall, by Mr. Galligan, by a whole crew of individuals who worked with Mr. Majanowski on a regular basis at the Chicago Police Department Gang Crimes Unit. Now, what's important about that is, in the court file, the state court file, there was a letter in there indicating, a letter from Jim Burns, who at the time was the United States Attorney for the Northern District of Illinois, indicating his knowledge of the investigation that was going on. There were the names of some assistant United States attorneys who were involved in that. There was an FBI agent who was present. They were aware of that. What was interesting about that particular case was, you just can't talk about the names and look at the names and say, well, you should have turned this over. You know, we got copies of the transcripts of the proceedings and everything, and you know, you have to read that. You can't just take the names in a vacuum, because while I realized the government's position had been that, well, a state court judge heard this evidence, heard the testimony, and made a ruling. Well, I don't think that precludes the federal court from revisiting the issue. Certainly people who are acquitted of serious felony crimes in state court are later indicted in federal court under conspiracies, charging them with those same crimes they've been acquitted of in state court. If the court had taken the time to perhaps evaluate this more seriously, I think it's very clear that starting right then and there is where we had the problem with the Brady Oneglio material.
You're talking about at the post-trial motion, if the hearing was more extensive, is that what you're
saying? No, the hearing in the Evelyn Miranda case was very extensive. Officer Majanowski testified, other officers testified, Evelyn Miranda testified, other witnesses testified.
That's not this case.
Well, that was...
I understand. Just give me the sequence. You're saying at an earlier criminal trial. Is that what you're speaking of?
Yes. I'm saying that the government became aware of Majanowski's narcotics dealing and his modus operandi of ripping off drug dealers. And quite frankly, when you read the transcripts, you know, there was a search warrant issued by a state court judge. When you do that and you read the transcripts, it's very clear that Judge Lynn, and all due respect to Judge Lynn, made a wrong decision in that particular case. And the government's position has always been, since Judge Lynn made a decision and it was final, we had no obligation to tell anyone about that. If we had known about that, that would have made it clear, for instance, that Mr. Escobar, who was the main witness in this particular case, was involved in the Majanowski-Martyr conspiracy. He was distributing drugs for the Majanowski-Martyr conspiracy. All of those drugs would have been attributable to the Majanowski-Martyr conspiracy. They would not have been attributable to this conspiracy. The bottom line in this case is the allegations in this indictment alleged 485 point something grams of narcotics. That's it. Yet my client was sentenced to life in prison. These other people were sentenced to extensive periods of incarceration. We didn't get an opportunity to investigate with that. If we had had that...
When did you find out about this?
About Evelyn Miranda?
Yeah.
After the trial.
That's
right. We found out on our own.
After the trial in this case?
Yes.
All right. Now, And at that trial, what did you find out?
At which trial?
The instant appeal, this trial.
Okay.
That's when you found out about this.
Yes, several months afterwards.
Right. And at the hearing before Judge Anderson, you sought to bring this out, right?
Yes.
All right. Now, what did you establish? What do you believe you established by way of knowledge by the U.S. attorney about the incident before the case before Judge Lynn?
Well, the U.S. attorney was aware of the investigation of the case before Judge Lynn. There were FBI agents who were scheduled to testify in that particular case. I don't recall if they did. There was a letter from Jim Burns directing that the FBI agents, if they testify in that case, should not divulge any information they learned about Mr. Majanowski and what he was doing other than what they learned from that particular case. Now, what information they had other than that, I don't know, because we never got to a point that we were able to find that out. We did, subsequent to this trial, subpoena all of the records of the Chicago Police Department Internal Affairs Division. They were brought to court, and Judge Anderson denied us access to them because the government objected to us seeing them. And I think that's because the Majanowski investigation was generating itself during that period of time, starting in the mid-1990s, and it would have exposed their investigation of Mr. Majanowski.
I appreciate all the possible strategies involved. What my focus and concern is, what the government knew before your trial started, that is, the government prosecutors knew before this about Woodall's involvement.
The government prosecutors knew that Mr. Woodall had been involved with Mr. Majanowski in what appears to be a modus operandi of ripping off drug dealers and stealing their...
And it's your position that Woodall went on the stand.
He did go on the stand.
Yeah, no, I understand that.
I saw him.
Yeah, I know you did. He went on the stand, and you were unaware of that contact.
Right, we were unaware of that completely. Right. And that contact also establishes, along with some of the other information that the prosecutors had with respect to, for instance, a woman by the name of Navarro, who was involved in the Majanowski case. Navarro was Escobar's girlfriend. They talked about Casper, being involved with Casper. Now, back then in 1997, 1998, the government knew who Casper was. Casper was Martyr. And Martyr was involved in a conspiracy with Navarro, and I believe he was involved in a conspiracy with Escobar. And if we had been given this information and had an opportunity to investigate it, we would have been able to show that. And it would have affected clearly the credibility of Escobar. Now, you know, people can say, as Judge Anderson said on a number of occasions, well, these guys were convicted by their own voices on the tape recordings. But it was Mr. Escobar who interpreted all the tape recordings. It was Mr. Escobar who knew when he was doing that he had been involved in a conspiracy with Mr. Martyr and Mr. Majanowski. And it explains the building at 2420 North Fullerton, I think was the address, that no one really had any knowledge of, with the exception of Mr. Escobar and I think Mr. Martinez. And I believe that was part of the Martyr conspiracy, Majanowski conspiracy. None of that should have been attributable to this conspiracy, and we weren't given an opportunity to look into that at all. And I think that was the problem in this particular case. In addition, again, to the motion that we filed prior to the trial with respect to the quantities of narcotics, I think if the government had been forced to divulge that, we wouldn't have had the problem, for instance, later on, where Escobar indicated that this conspiracy involved 150 kilograms of cocaine. Now, that was what came out during the trial. However, the government admitted in their post-trial proffer, their statement of the offense, that they became aware after Escobar testified, based upon Herrera deciding to cooperate, that it was more like 45 kilograms. Now, they had an obligation. The trial was still going on then. They had an obligation to tell the jurors that. They didn't do that. And that's another problem we had here. I think, you know, the problem was that these three prosecutors here in the courtroom, I don't believe they were involved in the Majanowski investigation.
Well,
and so,
what do you mean you don't believe? Did you try to establish that at the Judge Anderson's hearing?
Try to establish that they were involved in it?
Just their knowledge. The concern I think you're trying to present is that the government was possessed of information that should have been turned over to you before this trial commenced.
Right.
Right.
And I think someone in the U.S. Attorney's Office had to make that decision that they didn't want to prejudice their investigation.
Well, you know, why wasn't that examined at the hearing before Judge Anderson?
We didn't really, I don't think we really had a hearing as much as we had a discussion on the record. There were no witnesses called. We didn't have access to the records we subpoenaed. The judge wouldn't allow us to see those records. They weren't turned over. We weren't never put in a position.
What representations were made by the government about their knowledge?
I think the representations, I don't recall them specifically, but that they didn't know about this stuff. I mean, Mr. Levin, when he first advised us about Mr. Woodall, he advised us that Mr. Woodall had made certain representations to him, and that was all that he told him about, which I think seems to suggest that Mr. Levin didn't know anything about the Evelyn Miranda case at that particular point.
Did he know Mr. Woodall was under investigation?
I don't know if he personally knew that. I think people in the U.S. Attorney's Office had to know it through the Maginowski investigation, because Mr. Woodall was obviously under investigation for quite a period of time, as was Mr. Maginowski.
It's difficult for us to be the fact finder here, if not impossible.
Well, the problem is we weren't allowed an evidentiary hearing on this matter because we weren't allowed to have access to these materials. I think we made a strong showing that these materials indicate that they would have allowed us to investigate and more fully explore this and allow Judge Anderson to more fully explore that, and I think we were entitled to that. I think, based upon the quantity of narcotics in our pretrial motion, we're entitled to a new trial on that alone. But I think the question becomes, are we entitled to a new trial, or should this whole thing been dismissed because of misconduct on the part of the government? And Judge Anderson prevented us from getting to that point. He prevented us from having any hearing on that. Many of the things decided in this case were decided by in-camera submissions to Judge Anderson, to which I objected vociferously during the proceedings. But my objections weren't heard. I have really nothing else unless someone has a question.
Apparently not.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Collins. Mr. Levin.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, my name is Joel Levin. I'm an assistant United States attorney in the Northern District of Illinois. And I think it's important to put in perspective what the issue is with respect to the Giglio, because that clearly appears to be the principal issue raised in appeal. First of all, I think it is important to acknowledge the evidence at trial, what sort of trial this was. This was a trial, and I hesitate to put a percentage on the amount of tape evidence, but the overwhelming amount of evidence that came in during this trial consisted of tape recordings that were made of the defendant. The principal defendant, of course, was incarcerated during the course of the conspiracy. We had a year's worth of tapes. I think we introduced approximately 66 tape recordings, and the district court accurately and correctly concluded, to use his words, that in this case the conspirators' own words convicted them. And we're talking.
Let me cut at least to the chase for me. I recognize the overwhelming amount of tape evidence here. The government chose to put Woodall on the stand.
Right.
Now, that's it, because you need him in addition to all this taped evidence?
We put Woodall on the stand, and Woodall only testified about a discrete incident.
I don't care if he testified to time, temperature, and date.
Right.
Did the government know that at the time you put him on the stand, that he was under investigation for stealing cocaine?
The trial attorneys, myself included, did not know that. But in the post-trial hearings, we have, based on the Kyles Supreme Court case, based on the fact that CPD, the Chicago Police Department, Internal Affairs, knew it, we consider the knowledge imputed to the prosecution team. So we argued it and responded with that premise, that knowledge that he was under investigation should be imputed to the government. And let me address that. As I said, Woodall's role in this case, Woodall was not the investigating agent of this case. He was not the case agent. He testified as to the search of defendant Souffrant's home on February 5, 1996. He testified as to the evidence that was found during the course of that search. He basically cataloged the evidence.
He in the inventory.
Right.
I know there are many other officers.
Right. And that's basically it, what he testified to. What he testified to, the fact of the search, the fact that drugs were found and seized, the fact that a gun was found, all of those facts were discussed in tape conversations that occurred amongst the defendants in the days or months following that search.
Is your representation to this court, obviously it is, but and I appreciate and accept your representation as to trial counsel's
right.
knowledge, are you suggesting that it came to the U.S. Attorney's office? Let me just back this up. I'm looking to see what when this was housed, this information was housed in the U.S. Attorney's office, apart from the trial team.
Right. The information regarding the investigation of Woodall, the information that he was under investigation for, that the incident occurred March 5th of 98, and...
No, 96 is when he executed the warrant, right?
That 96 was... is when he executed the warrant. Right. The incident in which he's alleged to have stolen drugs, lied to his superior, occurred March 5th of 98. Obviously, CPD, IAD knew about it,
sure.
You know, at that time or shortly thereafter. But in terms of anyone actually within the U.S. Attorney's Office knowing that he was under investigation, no. It was not personally known to us at that time during the trial. But
you're not involved in the Majanowski investigation?
I'm not involved in the Majanowski
investigation.
I'm not, no. And let me speak to the Majanowski investigation, because I think it really is entirely a red herring in terms of any applicability or relevance or materiality to this case. I know counsel describes this Majanowski Marquier Escobar conspiracy going on. Escobar was a witness that we called in the case, but there's no evidence in the record of any such conspiracy involving Majanowski and our witness Escobar. The only thing that is in the record is in terms of any connection between Majanowski and Escobar in terms of things that were discovered after the trial is a plea agreement of Yolanda Navarro, in which, as part of the factual basis, she indicates that at some point Majanowski told her that Escobar was under federal investigation. But there's nothing indicating that Escobar was part of some drug dealing conspiracy with Majanowski. Let me return briefly to this issue with Woodall and what the significance of it was. What, just to sort of go back to what the facts were, how this unfolded. After the trial, when we did discover that Woodall was under investigation, we disclosed it to the defense, and of course that's what precipitated the post-trial motions. And ultimately, when Judge Anderson considered the allegations and they were disclosed to the defense, he concluded, based on the overwhelming evidence in the case, based on Woodall's testimony, if the defense had known about that investigation, and basically it's 608B, that's what it was, specific instances of misconduct. And presumably they would have done one of two things. Either they would have asked Woodall, impeached him with that, or alternatively perhaps kept Woodall off the stand. Either scenario would not have made any difference whatsoever in this case, given the evidence that came in and Woodall's limited role during the trial. And I think that conclusion by the district court is really irrefutable, based on the nature of this case, based on Woodall's role in it, and based on the nature of the impeachment evidence. I know the word exculpatory has been thrown around here, but there was no disclosure, no discovery of anything exculpatory in the sense of anything that undermined the verdict. That is to say, anything suggesting that someone testified at the trial falsely in any way. There was nothing like that. Now, counsel has made reference to this discrepancy between the amount of drugs that were in Escobar's plea agreement and the amount that ultimately the government pursued during his plea agreement at the time of his sentencing. But this was an issue that the defense cross-examined Mr. Escobar on, that is the discrepancy. They cross-examined him about it. It's mentioned in our brief. The citations are transcript pages 2132, 2143, 2205. Not only did they cross-examine him about it, but it was argued by the defense at closing that he was a liar because his plea agreement had said 150 kilograms, but that is not what he was owning up to at the trial. So that was not an issue that was discovered or disclosed after the trial. That's something the defense knew about, and they pursued vigorously during the course of the trial. There is mention of the Evelyn Miranda incident. This is another incident. It's a state court case in which a woman alleged that Chicago police officers had stolen drugs from her. And this incident occurred prior to the trial. But what happened was, first of all, Woodall's role in that, he, I believe, was one of 10 officers who was at the scene when that occurred. He was not the affiant on the search warrant. There was a state court hearing that had been held on that, and ultimately the state court judge determined that the accusations were meritless and that the officers were credible. That was the state of the record when this case went to trial. Ultimately, Miranda's accusations that these police officers were corrupt or had stolen or whatever, it appears that they bore fruit, but it was not, they did not bear any fruit at the time or by the time of this trial. There is no evidence whatsoever that anything that was withheld regarding meritorious accusations. And moreover, once again, what it would have been, even if it had been available or used by the defense, it would have been more 608B material that conceivably could have been used to cross-examine Mr. Woodall.
So basically, it's your position, Woodall was totally under the radar of you and Mr. Prosper.
That's correct. And Mr. Fullerton, who was the other, right,
yeah.
Right.
And it subsequent to the, after the conclusion of the trial, some office internal investigation produced his tie to this earlier investigation?
Right. After the trial was over, when Mr. Prosper discovered that there was this investigation, it was disclosed to the defense prior to the scheduled sentencing of the defendants. Right. So
did that come about from just talking to other assistants in the office? Is that how that evolved?
Because I was not personally privy to the discovery. I'm hesitant to say.
I mean, what's obviously troubling to me is Woodall, this case could have been prosecuted apparently without Woodall. So I mean, although the charges that Woodall and Escobar may have a tie, so I not only accept your representation, but I can see that Woodall wouldn't have been used. Apparently, but it is troubling that a Woodall type witness makes it into.
Well, let me say a couple things with respect to that. As the attorney who handled Woodall, his direct testimony, I did ask him, and this is in the record, what, if any, Giglio or integrity-related issues were in his background. And there was a relatively minor thing that he mentioned about some one-day proposed suspension or something. Which, that was it. There was no mention. He did not tell us anything about the pending investigation.
So basically, the prosecution team in this case, you say, had no contact. That would have, with the Majanowski investigation, prosecutors on that, that would have
well,
surfaced Woodall.
Not only that, the Majanowski investigation really did not gear up until after this trial was over. There was a Title III in the Majanowski investigation that occurred, I believe, in the fall of 1998, so it really didn't get into high gear, so to speak, until then. But beyond that, in your question, you alluded to a connection between Escobar and Woodall.
I'm not finding that.
All right.
Well, then I guess that would be a theory that would be argued in support of need to know about Woodall. That's all.
Right. And there is nothing in the record to suggest anything like that. I think the best that can be inferred or suggested from the record is that Woodall was a corrupt officer, Woodall stole drugs from people, that sort of thing. And to the extent, and there is a claim made in the briefs by the defendant that Woodall stole drugs during the course of the Souffrant warrant. That is speculation on their part, and moreover, I don't know, that would not have helped them to the extent that if Woodall had either admitted it or had they been able to establish that there were more drugs than Woodall had actually testified to. But once again, to get back to the point, there is nothing to suggest that Woodall did lie in his testimony, that he did anything corrupt or untoward in this case, anything that would diminish in any way the confidence in this verdict, in the judgments here. So
he could have used it to attack his general credibility.
Yes, yes, absolutely. If and to the extent the judge, given it was 608B, if they'd asked him about it and if he denied it, how far the judge would have allowed them to go with it, I don't know how much they could have gotten out of it, but that's correct. If they'd had it, they absolutely, presumably, could have at least asked him about it and taken it from there. But just to sort of finish this up on the Giglio, unless there are any other questions, this was definitely, the information that we discovered and disclosed after the trial was definitely impeachment information about a witness who was called, about a witness who had a limited role in the case, who testified about matters that were substantiated and corroborated by in the testimony as well as the transcripts that were introduced in the case. So when Judge Anderson concluded that it really would not have made any difference that the conspirators' own words convicted them, that was an absolutely sound and appropriate conclusion. I think it's hard to say it better or more succinctly than Judge Anderson did in his memorandum and order denying the motion for a new trial, in which he said that the staggering weight of the evidence at trial leads this court to the certain conclusion that there was no reasonable probability of a different result at the trial, even had all of the allegedly suppressed evidence been disclosed. That coming from the judge who obviously sat through this 9-week trial and was familiar with all the evidence, and as I've indicated, I think it's an absolutely sound conclusion. Before I conclude, I do want to briefly address the issues raised by Mr. Polola. There is no Apprendi issue in this. There's no meritorious Apprendi issue in this case. All of the defendants received sentences that were at or below the statutory maximum. Of course, all of them had the opportunity to contest and dispute about any drug quantities, and I think the record reflects that the judge was very fair and equitable in determining at the time of sentencing the quantities that were attributable to each of the defendants, but there is no Apprendi issue whatsoever. As far as this bill of particulars claim, of course, that was not raised in the briefs. It's not an issue before this court. And obviously the district court was completely within its discretion in denying the motion for a bill of particulars given the detailed indictment as well as the extent of discovery that was provided to the defendants. Your Honor, based on the record, in this case and the nature of the Giglio information, the extensive evidence introduced through the tapes, we would ask that that Your Honors affirm the judgments of all four of these defendants. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lynn. Mr. Carlson.
Hey, please report, counsel for the government. I want to address just briefly the Giglio argument. One of the things that Mr. Levin kept saying is there's nothing in the record to support. We tried to be able to make a record of these things. We asked Judge Anderson for a hearing. We wanted to be able to get to the bottom at the end of trial, that which we didn't have before or during the trial. And I think the one thing that is really important to bring out when names get thrown out, Martyr and Majanowski and everything, the real relevance in many respects to Majanowski, to this case, is that Majanowski was actually Woodall's partner. And he was Woodall's partner in the search of Souffrant's apartment to which would all testify to. The government made, obviously, a conscious decision in this case, and I would submit to you a decision based on the fact that they knew Maginowski was under investigation, not to call Maginowski as the witness in this case. So I think the government had knowledge at the time they made that decision as to Woodall's involvement in corrupt activities. And I think where a lot of this goes is to not what Woodall in fact testified to, but what we would have been able to learn about Woodall, about his connections to corrupt activities, but more importantly, as we get to that, to Maginowski, and from Maginowski to Martyr, and where that becomes important is part of the indictment in this case was a narcotics enterprise run out of 2420, I think it was 2420 North Kedzie, which involved, which the government claimed Mr. Martinez and Mr. Cologne were largely involved in. It was their position during the trial that that was a separate conspiracy to the conspiracy charged in this indictment. If they had had, and we had had the material to show that Martyr was dealing with Escobar and tied in with Maginowski, that would have allowed them to be able to argue and present evidence that that was not part of this conspiracy that was charged in this indictment, and therefore they would have had an argument, not just a sentencing argument on amount of drugs, but a separate conspiracy argument to argue to the jury. Without that information, we never had that opportunity to make those arguments at trial and back them up with anything. And so I think that is, I want the court to realize that some of what we're talking about here goes to that very issue, that which we didn't have and couldn't present. And I think had the government disclosed this material at an earlier date, we would have been able to follow through on this. And additionally, the reason the government can stand here today and say there is nothing in the record is because we weren't allowed to make the record before Judge Anderson to try and get to the bottom of these things. I have nothing other to say other than that. We would thank the court for its time, and the matters that we did not argue before the court, obviously we are not waiving, and thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.